We are the first generation to feel the impact of climate change and the last generation that can do something about it.
The key generation being already hit by climate change, but the key generation to make sure we respond to the biggest challenge of human history.
To solve this crisis, please remember always, political will is itself a renewable resource. Let's get busy renewing it today.
Fingers crossed governments do stick to their strategies and plans and even ramp them up.
This is Generation One from University College London, turning climate science and ideas into action.
So I'm Mark Masson, and as you know, I'm a professor of Earth System Science here at University College London. What does that mean? Well, I study climate change in the past, the present, and the future.
And I'm Simon Chenier. I'm in the Political Sciences Department here at UCL, and I look at everything from small island states to African countries and climate action all around the globe.
So, Simon, you were part of this amazing event that UCL organized with the Climate Reality Project and the Climate Cafe. It was on Valentine's Day, so of course, what did we call it? We called it Love Your Planet. And for me, what was the most amazing thing was Al Gore, the former Vice President of the United States and the founder of the Climate Reality Project, introduced the whole day in a video address.
We don't need to wait. We can act now. And the good news is, if we do, the science tells us that once we reach true net zero, global temperatures will stop going up almost immediately with a lag of as little as 3 to 5 years. And even more exciting, if we stay at true net zero, half of all of the human-caused greenhouse gas pollution will have fallen out of the atmosphere in as little as 25 to 30 years, and the long, slow healing process can get underway. And that all gives me a tremendous amount of hope. And it fuels my drive to continue pushing for action. But we've got to act, and I hope you feel the same way. And I'll simply close, as I often do, by saying that if you ever doubt that we have the political will necessary to solve this crisis, please remember always, political will is itself a renewable resource. Let's get busy renewing it today.
I'm always struck about how positive Al Gore is. And I love that saying, which is, of course, good political will is a renewable resource. And I keep using that again and again. And that really is what this podcast is about. It's about finding those solutions to deal with the climate crisis. Well, last time Simon and I were doing this podcast, we were talking about our experience, good and bad, at COP28. Now, in the last couple of months, we've already had the news that last year, temperatures hit 1.48 degrees above pre-industrial times. And if you take the last 12 months, I know that's a technical sort of like switcheroo, but we actually did go above 1.5 degrees. So we're into a new world, Simon.
We are into a new world, and I'm at least pleased to see that the international negotiations around climate change actually started ramping up already in January. So around the world, there are lots of actions being taken. As us here at UCL, Mark, I'm sure you are as well. I have a whole planning now over the next 12-month period, knowing where and how we are going to be working on the different climate negotiations around the world.
And I think that feeds into our Generation One podcast, because, of course, we're going to be looking over the next four episodes. We're going to be looking at global. We're going to look at the national level. We're going to look at what individuals can do. And we're also going to be focusing on what businesses can do to deal with the climate crisis. In today's episode, we're going to be focusing on global climate action. Where do we go from here? And what needs to be done on the global scale?
We're going to be asking some of these questions of our guest, Pierre Canet, who leads the public affairs and policy team of Planet Earth. I can already tell you that Pierre's work is truly global in scope. He works on policy advocacy, on very targeted environmental campaigns, and develops tools that will influence strategies aimed at adopting positive solutions to protect the environment. Pierre, welcome. Could you tell us a bit about Client Earth and what you do?
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be with you today. And it's an honor to share with you some thoughts, some ideas, and talk about what Client Earth is currently doing. Client Earth is a low charity, and I joined Client Earth because this is at a time of urgency, I think one of the rare NGOs to really use the power of the law to solve the climate and nature crisis. And this is fascinating what Client Earth is doing because we are increasingly global. And so we are working at the European EU level, in the UK, in Asia, in the US, and we have partnerships and local NGOs partnerships in Africa and South America. So this is amazing work with dedicated talents, experts, whether we're speaking of the communications, the lawyers, and I've been through the COP28 with these teams and can share the experience working at and with Client Earth.
Thanks very much, Pierre. We were both, Mark and I, at COP28 as well, so it's a shame our paths didn't cross then.
Well, there was about 100,000 people there, so Pierre, we probably actually walked past each other and just didn't notice. Pierre, I'm going to take a step back. This is the first time that global warming has technically exceeded the 1.5 degree target over a 12-month period. This doesn't actually represent necessarily a break of the landmark Paris Agreement, but it is incredibly worrying. I want to ask, how does that science feed into Client Earth, and how does that actually help you and your team?
So all of this science is guiding us, and the urgency to act, the way Client Earth is also driving its initiatives and projects, is guided by the most recent studies and science. And this is why, when we are speaking of climate change, that we are really advocating for climate laws to be science-based and to align with all the work being done. When you look at the urgency to act, whether you're speaking about reducing global greenhouse emissions or when you're speaking about adapting to climate change, of course, the temperature goal is guiding the urgency to act, but beyond this temperature goal, you have all the trajectories. And when you look at the 1.5 degrees Celsius, this is the temperature threshold that was decided in the Paris Agreement. And this is not Client Earth or NGOs who decided that. That agreement was actually signed off by almost all countries on Earth and signed off by the decision makers, by the leaders, with head of states and government being at the COP21 and then taking this agreement forward in their own jurisdictions and countries. So this temperature goal limit increase should be respected, and it's well below 2 degrees and 1.5 degrees Celsius. And so that is the compass of all actions to be undertaken country by country. This is the compass that needs to be translated in the different climate laws across the world. And against this objective, it's really the notions, whether we speak about reducing greenhouse gas emissions, whether we're speaking about adapting to climate change, or whether we're speaking about the finance and the governance piece. All of this is and needs to be included in the climate legal frameworks we are currently pushing for in different countries. The impact of climate change and consequences of this 1.1, 1.2, etc. being increasing, and how it translates with more heat waves, floodings, droughts, the level of sea rise as well. So all of this is tangible and we can already feel. And I, as a citizen, but also a lot of communities we are working with, when we're speaking about the Torres Strait Islanders in the Pacific, the impact seeing on different small island states. I was like, I don't know if you remember at COP26 in Glasgow, but having a minister from small island states being really engaging and being, you know, the feet in the water with a sea level rise, that was really like driving emotions. And we were really sensible to this and to see how the communities are being directly hit and affected by climate change. So my point to conclude is probably to consider us all that the temperature goal, it's a political commitment. It needs to be translated in local laws and domestic laws, but this needs to be connected with a purpose of why we don't want to see much increase. We want this to be limited to 1.5. It's because a world of 1.5 is a very different world of 2 degrees. And this is what science is telling us.
And I like how you put people at the center of this and that you're centering it on the science. That's important. But the other aspect of this is that climate justice piece that you talked about, Pierre, which I'm really intrigued in, because climate justice for a Torres Strait Islander, for example, and as someone who works on Pacific Islands a lot, it means something different for different people. So at the recent COP28, the countries had agreed to submit their updated climate plans for that 2035 period that's supposed to be aligned with the 1.5 degree target that you've been talking about. But I guess my question is it just too slow?
It is, unfortunately. And the most striking thing is that when you look at the science, the outcome of the COP28 is about the global stocktake. So it's global stocktake means that parties, the countries in the room of the COP28, in the plenary, who actually concluded the outcome, are aware that it's going too slow. And we are saying that, scientists are saying that, but the thing is that these stakeholders globally, the parties, the countries, the representatives and governments in the room, are acknowledging that it's not going fast enough. What UNEP is telling us, the UN Environmental Programme, the scientists, the reports, there is one that is very interesting, it's called the GAP Report, it's an annual report, that it needs to go 4 times faster. So to your question, is this too slow? All and everybody is saying it's not going fast enough. And if you need to look at the numbers, we need to go 4 times faster. And this is why at COP28, but also in this critical year, there is no room to roll back. There is no room to backlash. There is no room for all the attempts to harm environmental policies. The question is simple. It's how the decisions, the laws, the policies can help us with justice as well to accelerate action and ambition.
You're listening to UCL Generation One, turning science and ideas into climate action.
Pierre, you and Client Earth have a real deep insight into the legal frameworks and the policies in different countries. So can I ask you, which countries do you think are really holding us back? And please feel free to name and shame.
Okay, so the question about name and shame and to understand what are the capacities, the context, the situations as well across the world. When you look at the what we call global stocktake that was concluded and negotiated at the COP28, it's clear from the numbers I just shared. Nobody is at the level. No one on Earth, no country, is really the big champion. This said, it's important as well that we are looking in the climate laws about the targets and the numbers. So we might have, for instance, ambitious countries while it's going to net zero in terms of targets and pledges. Let's say, for instance, the EU carbon neutrality by 2050. The UK has its own net zero as well pledges. But at the end, what is to us, Client Earth, critical for Client Earth, is to look in the details, understanding what is currently being implemented and done. What are the key strategies to make sure that these pledges are being implemented? You have reports being done to measure the progress against, for instance, renewables, against energy efficiency, around climate finance. And when you look as well at the progress made, some countries like Uruguay, Denmark, Jordan, Chile, some of them are making progress. When you look at the solar and the wind generations, it's going at rapid scales. And we can, on renewables, have and look, it's also in different two different reports. So what we are looking at for Client Earth is this question of enforcement, implementations, and making sure the pledges are translated in the reality And that's why we have, on very specific cases, the need to activate legal cases against governments on very specific issues. I think that we need to look more in details when countries made pledges, like I mentioned for the EU and the UK, and really be specific around what we are expecting from governments. Other organizations and institutions are making some interesting rankings, so it can be used by Client Earth to look at the details and understanding what is going on. But at the end, we are very focused on what needs to be done country by country on climate, and if we need to activate specific legal cases to make sure that we are taking into account governments and companies.
Yeah, again, it goes back to this idea of climate justice, doesn't it? That was very comprehensive, what you just given. I'm just wondering now, when it comes to, for example, the Alliance of Small Island States or the African Group of Negotiators, for whom they have little to mitigate, they have little to cut in terms of emissions. So what do you see as the biggest threats then when you're analyzing these countries and their implementation? What do you see as the biggest threat to not implementing these strategies or even coming up with weak strategies?
I'd say we have many threats across the world currently regarding the strategies. First one is about, you know, the lack of trust and the fact that this is a global issue and we need to find a way countries are cooperating, working together against this planetary crisis and the response that are global, but the proofs, I would say, of love and of trust to be found country by country, put on the table, whether we speak of, for instance, climate finance, which is critical, 100 billion finance, but loss and damage with a new fund created and making sure that then we are seeing more financial commitments on the table, that we are seeing as well the implementation of funding programs to be looked at it very very carefully. So this question of trust is central. Heading up to the trust, I would say that a big risk identified by the World Economic Forum is about the misinformation, the disinformation, and how all of this regarding climate, nature, and actions to be undertaken to respond to the crisis are being threatened by very like targeted campaigns against climate action, and it's being done by specific interests and lobbies across the world, and it's being targeting citizens and future voters. But of course, in the democracies, the decision makers themselves are being influenced and targeted by this misinformation. So as we are approaching a year of elections, it's as well regarding this misinformation and the question of trust to make sure that the future governments and future mandates will be fully used with decision makers aware of their own responsibilities and the ability for them to respond. Because when you are head of state, when you are head of governments, when you're a member of the parliament, the responsibility against this reality is to protect people. So we are looking at all of this in this critical year to make sure that we can respond to the challenge you asked me about and that we can address these different risks in a critical year.
Pierre, so 2024 is probably going to be the hottest year on record, but it's also an election year with something like 50 countries, 2 billion people going to vote in elections. How do you perceive this is going to affect climate policy and action?
This year will be critical for the next decades or more, because all the decisions taken in the next mandate will impact our generation. That is, as you introduced, the key generation being already hit by climate change, but the key generation to make sure we respond to the biggest challenge of human history. So this is about this generation, and it's about the next generation and the future generations, because the decisions made today are impacting the ecosystems, the oceans, the climates, the pollutions put here on Earth will last for decades and sometimes centuries. So all of these decisions for the next mandate have a direct impact on the present, but let's not forget about the future as well on Earth and future generations. And it's important for people to realize that Earth and life on Earth is on the ballot. So we have this year elections where the voters and as well the parties and politicians in charge of finding the solutions to respond to the crisis need to realize the challenge for the next mandates to really put in place the right decisions and the right rules and the right laws in place to respond to this biggest challenge we had as humanity to solve. So having in mind, if you go beyond the environmental aspects and you focus on the economy and you focus on the jobs and you focus on the resiliency of our societies in front of climate change and biodiversity loss, nothing will be possible without a healthy planet and healthy ecosystems and healthy ocean and stable climates in the next years and decade. And so for decision makers, whatever the party, to consider, whatever the approach, that all these decisions in the next years will have a direct impact on the economies, on jobs, on the well-being of farmers when they are confronted to increasing droughts, for instance, and heat waves. So all of this needs to be really considered when life on Earth is on the ballot. We need to make sure that the voters, the parties, the next elected decision makers will have in mind these challenges in a very integrated manner, and putting the environment, health of people and ecosystem and justice at the center of their project, at the center of their decisions. Whatever happens, there is one thing sure, is that Climate Earth will be keeping to take to account companies and governments. This is the mission we had, and we'll continue to do that.
So, Pierre, I mean, a lot of the younger people are deeply frustrated, and many of them are now taking direct action. Can I ask, why is the approach of Client Earth so important? And why do you feel this is a much better route to take than, say, perhaps direct action?
There are many routes and many avenues and many ways to do it. And I think the most important thing is to be respectful to this DNA. Currently, I joined Client Earth because I believe, as the global head of policy and public affairs, I believe in the power of the law. I believe in the way we used the law and in the way we won cases, when I mentioned as well the Torres Strait Islanders, the way to protect the communities. So this is a key lever we are using as Client Earth. And that's why I'm championing it, because I believe in it. And this is why I joined as well Client Earth and happy to work with lawyers on it. But we should not oppose what we are doing with how the others are reacting to it. I'm not positioned to criticize or to say to anybody what needs to be done. I'm just here to say, if you want to join us, if you are a lawyer, a law student, if you're believing in the power of the law, then support us and come to us. If you're believing and feel that your action in the street, that your action in a cooperative, for instance, for organic food is useful, do it. And I really want to invite people, because we have a lot of eco-anxiety currently. And my way to solve the eco-anxiety is I joined Client Earth, because I know that with little actions I'm doing, I'm trying to compensate the burden and the fact that I'm really afraid of what's going on and the big wave we are seeing, and the science and the numbers and the news and the fact we don't have policies in place. And so for young people who are willing to join Client Earth or other legal actions, it's really up to you to define that. And I'm also thinking the question could have been, how is it working with corporate engagement and people in the companies being proactive to move from the inside and trying to influence from the inside as well corporate decisions? So I think it's complementary, and I think I'm not positioned to judge or evaluate any other levers. I'm here to say why I think this is a good lever and why the law is powerful. And when I look at the cases we launch, I'm looking at the different victories. When I look at the advocacy we're doing, I believe in the power of the law. And I feel that changing in our democracies the laws can have an effect. This is how we've been functioning in the past centuries in many democracies. And this is how the rule of law is, I think, so important to work in democracies around this justice and law component.
Thank you, Pierre. I have to say, I think that people sometimes forget that the rule of law, the use of the law, the use of the frameworks of our society are absolutely essential for dealing with these crises. And this is why some organizations like your client Earth and yourself are so important. So thank you so much for joining this podcast. And I have to say, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you.
And we'll be watching with you over the coming 12 months to see all of these different outcomes, to make sure and to hope and fingers crossed governments do stick to their strategies and plans and even ramp them up.
Yeah, I don't think I'm going to have any fingernails left by the end of some of these elections. But yes, I agree. We'll be watching with you.
Thank you. I'd like just to thank you for the podcast you're doing, because it's an ability for us to share our thoughts and the encouragement we can share with you to continue the discussion.
Absolutely. Brilliant. We need to keep the conversation going. Yeah.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Pierre. That's it for this episode of Generation One from UCL, turning climate science and ideas into action. But stay tuned for the rest of the series, or listen on demand to all our episodes on your favorite platform. If you'd like to ask a question or suggest a guest that you'd like to hear on Generation 1, you can email us on podcasts@ucl.ac.uk. Otherwise, for more information about UCL's work in the climate space and what our staff and students, as well as our researchers, are doing to make sure that we don't just talk the talk, but we walk the walk on to a more sustainable future, head to the UCL Generation 1 website or follow us on social media, #UCLGeneration1.